May it please the court.
Sir.
Supreme Court Rule 29.15E refers to the appointment of counsel. Then it describes counsel's obligations and duties throughout that rule to do a minimal representation of the individual, to review the record, to make an assessment whether it's appropriate to file an amended motion or whether or not there's just really nothing there. And a statement to that effect is given both to the court and obviously discussed with the imprisoned inmate. It has nothing in there describing counsel's obligations or duties to indicate there's any distinction between whether counsel is appointed or retained. It uses the phrase counsel. It does not use the phrase appointed. It could very easily, the framers could very easily have said that that particular requirement in 29.15e applies only to appointed counsel and not to retained counsel, but it did not. And it's nowhere is it distinguished. And in fact, in Biddick versus State, this court ruled that in the circumstances in which there is a pro se defendant who wants to represent himself in a post-conviction proceeding, he can do so even though it's not mentioned in the rule. And I think that it is incumbent to administration of the system of justice that we use that there's no distinction between whether the counsel is retained or appointed. This case has referred post-Price, and Price is the case that the Attorney General relies on. Price is the case that was the driving force behind the opinion in the court below. This court has routinely used the phrase post-conviction counsel as opposed to appointed counsel and as opposed to retained counsel. And I've used that phrase in James versus State, which was decided after Price, Lulla versus State, which was decided after Price, and Biddick versus State, and Barton versus State, all of which were decided after the Price decision. Furthermore, there were a number of cases that had been decided that had ruled that there was no distinction between obligations and duties that an appointed counsel had that was distinguishable from what a retained counsel had. In Silver versus State, Roberts versus State, Bustamante versus State, and Castor versus State, the Court of Appeals specifically indicated that there was no distinction to be drawn between whether counsel was retained or appointed. And in those, and in the Price case, did not mention those cases, nor did it indicate it was overruling or distinguishing those cases. So I think that particular body of law still exists, and I think it's appropriate to follow it in this particular case.
So, counsel, your position is that when retained counsel comes in, they should be allowed and granted an extension of time. If the second retained counsel comes in and requests extension of time, or third or fourth, every future potential retained counsel would have the ability and should be granted an extension of time if they wish?
That is not my position at all. Okay, Stanley versus State, which was decided after the hearing court in this particular case, allowed an extension of time. Stanley said you can't do that. And I think it's clear now that the law is you can't do that. And of course, it isn't very much. It doesn't seem very logical for an individual who's incarcerated to say, I just want to put this off forever and never want to have my day in court. Obviously, you want it as quickly, but as effectively.
So part of the state's brief addresses that issue, but that was an earlier issue. It's not one you raise here.
I'm sorry?
Part of the state's brief, I believe, it addresses that issue about do new time periods start, but that was may have been an issue below, but it's not in this court.
It's not an issue in this court. And it wasn't an issue in the court below. We did not argue at that time that we should have been granted an additional 60 days because Stanley made it clear.
Your only argument is about whether you can be abandoned by retained counsel as well as by appointed counsel.
Exactly. Whether or not the abandonment doctrine that is recognized in Lulloff and in Sanders. And Sanders used the same phrase, post-conviction counsel, in making an assessment and determination that there was abandonment. And in Sanders, there was nothing filed. And Lulloff, which was a companion case, it was untimely filed, which was the circumstances here. And Price had talked about whether or not the, you know, the court was not responsible for the fact that the initial pleading was not filed in a timely manner. And this is a big distinction in this case, is that this is the amended pleading, which does require legal help and legal expertise, as compared to the initial complaint that was filed in Price 4 years, 4 years after the conviction had become final, which actually runs exactly opposite to the purpose of the 2915, which is to ensure a timely response and a assessment of whether or not the trial and the conviction is constitutional and appropriate in a timely manner, so that there's some finality. This case was a situation which was 4 months, distinction between when the court granted and when an amended motion was filed. And I think it's important to note that the court, you know, is in part responsible for the breach because they granted the motion. And that's a distinguishing characteristic from Price, because in Price, this court noted that the court didn't have anything to do with the breach, to the failure of the attorney to file the initial claim.
But here you're not claiming error by the trial court or that it should be considered timely. You're saying you were abandoned because no timely motion was filed.
That's right. You know, I don't think there's any choice I have after the decision in Stanley. The court should not have granted the extension, although at the time the court granted it, it was okay.
Stanley hadn't been decided.
Stanley had not been decided. So that, you know, the client, the appellant in this particular case is sort of caught in this catch-22, because he thought his lawyer was doing the right thing. The court thought his lawyer was doing the right thing. The prosecution thought his lawyer was doing the right thing. And everyone thought the court was doing the right thing. But that didn't happen in this particular case because Stanley pretty well resolved that issue.
It all depends, doesn't it, ultimately on the wording of our rule? Can you address that?
I think it does. I think if the rule specifically set out, this only applies to appointed counsel because the court's sort of taken a supervisory role to make sure that that counsel does the minimum level of representation. And it does not appoint, that does not apply to retained counsel. And truthfully, that doesn't seem to make much sense. First of all, it drives defendants away from retaining counsel. And it could be a situation where, because counsel's retained, and misses the filing date, or something like happens in this case, that individual never gets his case heard in court. And that's a violation of Article 1, Section 14, that he should have the opportunity to present his case. It's a recognized cause of action. That's true here. If the cause is being restricted, that it would be true here. And the restriction is arbitrary or unreasonable. And I believe that's also true here.
The Court of Appeals found that the plain language of subsection or subdivision E makes clear it applies to only the motion court and appointed counsel. And so that at least part of the rule seems to have limited application to only appointed counsel. Can you respond to that?
It doesn't use that phrase. It uses what it says in 2915E is that if the defendant is indigent, and of course that's another wrinkle to this particular case, because if the court doesn't find the person indigent, then he has to retain counsel, and if that counsel messes up, then that's the end of it for him. But it says that the court is to appoint counsel if the movement is indigent. It then goes on to describe the role that counsel has. It never again says appointed counsel. It never says this only applies to appointed counsel.
I saw in your brief you argued that the next section does mention appointed counsel, so when they want something to only apply to appointed, they use the word
that's
appointed.
That's right.
Because they say all counsel can withdraw. If appointed counsel withdraws, the court shall cause new counsel to be appointed. But that in E, they don't limit the need to file an amended motion to appointed counsel. And, of course, private counsel couldn't file an amended motion.
Correct. So I think that demonstrates that the court had some, you know, idea of what they were doing when they used those those particular words, and I think the plain meaning of the rule should be applied in this particular case for a number of reasons, not only in its interpretation, which is interpreted similar to statutes, but also it just makes sense, you know, and it isn't arbitrary or unfair. And there are sister states we cite to in our brief who have addressed this particular issue. We know that he does not have a constitutional right to effective assistance of post-conviction counsel. There is a slight carve in Martinez versus Ryan from the U.S. Supreme Court to that, but only as it pertains to procedural default. There has been no ruling from this court or from the U.S. Supreme Court that an individual has a constitutional right to effective assistance. We understand that. But there must be some minimal level. And there are the Tennessee courts, the Illinois courts, the Florida courts, and blocking it. Four courts that I'm aware of that have all really referred and addressed this particular issue of private versus retained counsel. And this is the first time it has really come up. The closest it's come up is in the Price case, and that was not a case in which the counsel had made any failures after a motion had been filed, after these obligations and duties could be imposed upon that counsel. It was before that, and the court recognized that that was a distinguishing characteristic. And that characteristic also was referred to in Barton, in which the court recognized that there is an obligation on the part of the counsel to do what he has to do under the rule, but the court found that he did it. He filed an amended motion. It was a pretty excellent motion from what I could tell from reading the opinion. So I think that all those things are significant, and that red light's blinking.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The question of whether the motion court could have granted a second extension, true, Stanley was decided 2 weeks after the motion court in this case granted a second extension of 60 days to file the amended motion. But 20 years before the motion court entered that order, this court in a state against White clearly held that only one extension can be granted and that a second extension is unauthorized under the post-conviction rules. Furthermore, the rule itself says only one extension not to exceed 30 days can be granted in post-conviction cases. So the motion court, I'm just simply looking at the rule, demonstrates that second extensions are not permitted. In the brief, in Mr. Gittermeier's brief, they attempt to say that this court's opinion in Price is obiter dicta because the issue there was the failure of counsel to retain counsel to file the initial post-conviction motion and not the amended motion. The state does not believe that you can just dismiss everything that's said in Price as obiter dicta.
Price didn't say anything about what retained counsel could do. It was an appointed counsel. It was talking about, it didn't purport to address this issue, did it, about whether you can be abandoned by retained counsel?
I think it did.
Was that an issue in the case? I mean, but I was not aware in signing onto it that it said that, so tell me where it said that.
Well, I think it was an issue. First, I'll say the issue was not, this is an issue of first impression for this court. Can a post-conviction defendant be abandoned by retained counsel for the late filing of an amended motion? The issue in Price was, can a post-conviction defendant be abandoned by the untimely filing of the initial pro se motion. So to answer that question in Price, the court had to consider what is the scope of abandonment. And in Price, the court makes it unmistakably clear throughout the opinion that abandonment is a doctrine that emanates from subdivision E of both post-conviction rules, that it was created to enforce the requirements placed on appointed counsel in those in subdivision E of both post-conviction rules. So in reaching the holding that you cannot be abandoned by retained counsel in the filing of the initial motion, the court necessarily had to decide what the scope.
Well, what it said is a pro se motion is by definition not counsel. The counsel is not filing that motion. And so counsel doesn't have a role and can't have abandoned something it's never obligated to do. I mean, counsel doesn't file the pro se motion.
And the state's not arguing that Price controls.
Are you arguing E only applies to appointed counsel?
Yes.
So that means retained counsel can't file an amended motion, has no authority to do so? Because E is the only place we talks about amended motions and when they're required and what you can put in and so forth, and you're saying none of those requirements about what the amended motion should do and or about filing something in lieu of the statement in lieu of the pro se motion, none of those apply to retained counsel? G talks about signing it, but the requirements for the amended motion are set out in E. Are you saying those don't apply to retained counsel? Because the only place they talk about how you have to include the other claims and so forth are in E. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think G talks about amended motions generally, and the
but
timing
he says,
of it.
Counsel shall ascertain whether sufficient facts supporting the claims are asserted in the motion and whether the movement has included all claims. If not, then you file blah, blah. None of that applies to retained counsel. You're saying that whole paragraph only applies to appointed?
The duties set out in E does not apply to retained counsel. Retained counsel or a defendant who, under Bittig, decides to represent himself or herself, they have no duty to perform under E. There's no duty to amend the initial pro se motion by retained counsel or pro se defendants that want to go by themselves. When the first line talks about the court shall cause counsel to be appointed for indigent movements, the very next sentence is counsel shall ascertain, and in Price, and the state's position here is that counsel refers to the counsel appointed for the indigent defendant. That counsel has these duties. And another reason why we know, just from the plain language, but another reason why we know is the provision for a statement in lieu of an amended motion. I think most post-conviction defendants would be surprised to get a letter from their retained counsel saying thank you for the retainer, but I'm deciding to file a statement in lieu of an amended motion. That requirement there peculiarly applies to only appointed counsel, and it's this court's method of ensuring that counsel appointed under the post-conviction rules perform the duties required in E, the duties that this court has put on appointed counsel. The presumption is, from the way the rules are written and just how this law has developed, that anyone retaining counsel, that retained counsel is between that post-conviction defendant and retained counsel, and retain counsel's ethical duties under the rules of professional conduct, how they want to conduct the case and what they want to do to further that post-conviction case. E strictly applies to appointed counsel, as this court either held or unmistakably tells us in Price. And in many other several cases where this court has talked about in its opinions that the provisions of subdivision E apply to appointed counsel.
It doesn't appear that the cases decided by this court and the courts of appeals have kept that as, have previously recognized that or kept that as in their mind, because there are cases by this court that refer to a pro se, you know, the rules designed to have a pro se litigant file it, and were not, you know, the requirements for the original motion are such for a pro se. So that would seem to be contrary to contemplating retained counsel would file the motion. In fact, I think we've said, you know, a movement doesn't get a break if they have retained counsel on complying with those obligations. So, and I'm trying to think, I think there are other cases where we have not fully embraced or recognized any the distinction that you're now arguing. Would you, I'm not saying that they go entirely the other way, but I think if you look at the precedent out of the Court of Appeals in this court, it would be confusing as best.
The state agrees that there's been language used, instead of saying appointed counsel, there are cases that say post-conviction counsel, not differentiating between appointed and retained. And the state concedes that there are those cases out there. And they pointed out a case that followed Price, Barton, used the phrase post-conviction counsel in describing the extent of abandonment instead of appointed counsel. Though in Barton, that quote comes from Crenshaw, and Crenshaw was decided before Price. The state's position on the cases that say post-conviction counsel is simply that it was just imprecise use of language dealing with a situation that not dealing with a situation like this. In those cases where it just says post-conviction counsel, there wasn't this, you know, is there a difference between retained and appointed counsel? So which might explain the use of somewhat imprecise language. If we go all the way back, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I was going to ask you about a specific case, so go right ahead.
If you go all the way back to Lulliff, where this abandonment doctrine was created, it's very clear that the court created abandonment to enforce the provisions of Subdivision E and the duties of appointed counsel. And if you start from Lulliff, and the state in its brief has put as many cases as it could find, there's several that talk about the duties of appointed counsel over and over, though the state does concede there are some other opinions that you just use the phrase post-conviction counsel. I think in light of Price that we now know clearly from Price that Subdivision E, the duties there apply to only appointed counsel.
So your argument depends on Price's reading of the rule and your understanding of Price's reading of the rule. Prior to Price, you would not have made the same argument?
Well, prior to Price, well, yes, because if you go all the way back to Lulliff, and that's where Price...
Abandonment was started because it was determined that complete absence of appointed counsel doing anything had the effect of counsel never being appointed in the first place.
Right.
That's how it started.
I would agree with that.
The doctrine was created because absence of any behavior by appointed counsel was tantamount, to use the language of all those cases, Lulliff and others, was tantamount to having counsel not appointed in the first place.
And that's where Lulliff was the complete absence of any work by appointed counsel, and Sanders was the failure to timely file the amended motion. And in both cases, because this court created this rule giving appointed counsel duties, Lulliff and Sanders explains that there was going to be this limited doctrine of abandonment created, limited to only those two situations. And as we know from Price, and I believe it's mentioned in Barton, the reason why it's important that the abandonment be limited to only those two situations and only apply to the duties of appointed counsel is because federal courts look at this to see whether a post-conviction defendant has exhausted his state remedies. If abandonment gets if abandonment is made to be something beyond what Price and other cases have said, it's only these two things, then federal courts, which they have done in the past, will tell post-conviction defendants seeking federal habeas to go back.
They're not trying to expand it. They're saying it applies to post-conviction counsel, which is what many, many cases say.
True, Your Honor. And the state's position is, in those cases, that was simply imprecise use of language, that it applies to appointed counsel.
And did the federal courts interpret that to suddenly expand what you have to litigate in state court? The parade of horribles you're giving us didn't seem to have arisen from these prior cases.
Well, I think in Price, there's a footnote in Price that talks about what happened in the it's either Price or, and I may be mistaken about which case it was, but there is a footnote that talks about what happened in between a court of appeals opinion and when this court set the record straight, that the federal court started telling post-conviction defendants, go back to the state courts because the court of appeals has found this another prong to the abandonment doctrine. And the court set the record straight.
But my point is, opposing counsel is arguing it's not another prong. They're simply saying post-conviction counsel has this obligation, that prior cases have said that. It may be right or wrong,
right,
but it hasn't created some... they haven't said it applies in other situations. They've simply said the same situation.
In those cases where what you contend is loose language is used, is there any discussion about whether any of those lawyers were retained or were appointed?
In most cases, and I'm trying to think, in nearly all, it was where two appointed counsel, you know, one had withdrawn and another one had entered.
I haven't looked at the cases, but opposing counsel cites three, which he says dealt with privately retained counsel: Silver, Roberts, and Bustamante.
Silver did. Silver, the state did not make the argument it was making here. But Silver did involve post-conviction counsel, retained counsel, untimely filing, an amended motion, which should not have been considered abandonment, but the Court of Appeals in Silver remanded it for an abandonment inquiry under Moore. The state did not make that argument. Bustamante, the court found that the Court of Appeals found that the amended motion was not untimely filed, so there was no consideration of abandonment. Roberts, the opinion in the state's view is unclear on whether the counsel was retained or appointed. So we don't think it could be cited as precedent for holding that.
So does Silver need to be overruled?
Yeah.
Well, Silver should not be followed to the extent it suggests that there's abandonment by post-conviction counsel in the sense that the court remanded the case for an abandonment inquiry. Castor from the Eastern District is a case that needs to be overruled because it expressly holds that abandonment also applies to retained counsel, and the state in its brief has cited Castor, explained the facts, and explained that it needs to be overruled in light of the state's position here and the court's opinion in Price.
Is Castor the one that was, yes, it was one referenced by the Court of Appeals in this case?
Yes. And this is an Eastern District case, and the Court of Appeals in this case acknowledged that Castor said something different, but that Castor probably can't stand in light of this court's opinion in Price.
If we look at the purpose behind post-conviction rule, how is that purpose served by your interpretation versus how would it be served by Mr. Gettemeyer's interpretation?
Well, it's faithful adherence to the rules. It's faithful adherence to when this abandonment was created in Lulliff.
The reason I'm asking is we anticipate the need for an amended motion because of pro se initial motion, and that the pro se, the person who is incarcerated is not going to have the legal expertise to determine what are the best claims and how to articulate them. And since we seem to, I'm trying to decide if we have been consistent in expecting that there will be an original pro se motion, even in cases where you have retained counsel, therefore you would have the same need for an amended motion versus, I can't think that the cases expect that the original motion would be filed by the retained counsel, so therefore there would be not the same need to have an amended motion. The question is, do we anticipate even when there is subsequently retained counsel, the initial motion is going to be pro se?
I think that anticipation would not be incorrect because that's generally what happens. I think in Lulaf, and as outlined by this court in Price, there's been a line drawn. E places duties on appointed counsel. The court, in creating abandonment, drew that line when a non-indigent defendant has the ability to hire counsel. I think this court can rightly presume that counsel is going to retain counsel, paid counsel, is going to fulfill the duties that.
But that doesn't always happen, is that correct?
And it doesn't always happen. But that doesn't mean, if you expand abandonment to this situation, the tether on abandonment now is subdivision E. If you expand abandonment to this situation, it's not tethered in the rule anymore, and then it becomes what's the next step down the line.
I know there was a case out of the Western District that dealt with the remedy that a prisoner has against counsel if in a post-conviction case if they don't properly perform their responsibilities. And this gives the person more of a right to recover from counsel's failure to act. And I think in the Court of Appeals case it found that a public defender was also subject to malpractice claims, which the remedy is not very satisfying, that they might recover money damage as opposed to have an opportunity to get relief from a bad conviction. And so that's part of the question I have is, if we expect pro se to file it and then retain counsel to do the amended motion, that it seems that the prisoner suffers the same consequences that they would have with appointed counsel, that they don't have an opportunity to, if they are abandoned. You're saying they shouldn't get relief if it's retained counsel, but it seems policy-wise there's ought to be the same public interest in having a person have a right to fully adjudicate a claim of claims that can be raised under post-conviction.
The important thing to remember on this is that subdivision E does not create a right to effective assistance, does not really create a right for the prisoner at all, other than when your counsel is appointed, the court is going to ensure that these duties are performed. As much for the court, as Price talked about, as for the motion court and the appellate courts as it is for the defendant. And that's
why is that less important in a retained counsel circumstance as it is in an appointed counsel circumstance?
Just because that's what the rule provides.
How about a quick question? Doesn't the public defender's office, as a matter of course, feel like they have an obligation to appeal every post-conviction, to appeal every criminal case?
I don't know what their philosophy is on that, but from our end, it sure seems like that's what they do.
That's right, but not every case where there are retained counsel is there an appeal.
And that may also be true. And also, the public defender's office does not have a statutory obligation to represent post-conviction defendants. That's been placed on them by the post-conviction rules, by subdivision E, when they get appointed, and you have these minimal duties only to post-conviction, only to appointed counsel, not to retain counsel. And I completely apologize for going so far over.
You were answering questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Cutting never end. Okay. There is, I think it's crazy to argue that there's a presumption in the rule that it only applies to appointed counsel. That could have been said. It was right there for the framers to say it. They never said it. And there are courts of appeals that talked about Silva, we talked about Roberts, we talked about Bustamante, we talked about Casper, who have said it, that there should be no distinction. Culler versus Sullivan, U.S. Supreme Court case, says you know there should be no distinction between retained counsel and the duties of appointed counsel. And there should be no punishment for someone who does retain counsel.
Counsel, you cast the question as to why and whether an indigent, defendant who's not indigent, who has retained counsel, should get less protection than one who is indigent and who has appointed counsel. Let me turn that around and see how you would respond to this question. Why is it that we give more protection to the indigent counsel and to the indigent defendant and his appointed counsel than the ordinary run-of-the-mill litigant in civil proceedings? And at least in Price, one of the reasons given was that it's the court who decides who the lawyer will be for an indigent prisoner, and it's the prisoner himself who decides in a retained counsel case. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that there was a discussion in Price concerning the issue of agency, but I believe that that's also compounded by and confused in this particular case, because the court did play a role in granting the extended time, which did not happen in Price. And this court specifically pointed out the fact that the court had no role in whether or not there was abandonment. I mean, all I can say to you is it seems to me that there is no logical distinction between the obligations that a private attorney should afford his clients and what an appointed attorney should afford his clients. There are, we all know, situations in which retained counsel, because we've cited the cases, have not performed those duties appropriately. And when the state argues about all these times they use the phrase appointed counsel, that's because that's the fact. They are appointed counsel. So it isn't a matter of the court saying, because they're appointed, it's just basically drawing from the facts that they have. And Barton does not distinguish between retained and appointed counsel. And I think that basically ruling that if you are retained, you don't have any obligations, does not further the system of justice. It's a violation of Article 1. And it happens. It happens in these cases. And the conviction that stands could be totally unconstitutional. I know of a case in which it was a capital case, and the lawyer did not ask a single question of any witness at any time during the entire trial.
The PCR hearing or the underlying trial? The PCR hearing or the underlying trial?
The underlying trial.
Well, there's a constitutional right to effective counsel retained or no.
I understand that. But under his, if, for example, the family went, we're not going to trust the public defender anymore, look what they did, and they retained an attorney, that conviction would stand if that attorney was one day late in filing an amended motion, or if he simply didn't do it. So I think that the purpose behind the 2915 rule is to bring finality and do so promptly and appropriately. And that will not be furthered by removing retained counsel from their obligations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.